So, good afternoon. Anthony, thanks for this introduction. My name is Kurt Kleijs. Work for Microsoft for the Windows Azure platform as a technology solution professional. And in this MSDN Live meeting, I will talk about architectural guidelines, especially about scalability for applications on the Windows Azure platform. First of all, just another introduction on Windows Azure. If you want to start with Windows Azure, what you need as a developer is Visual Studio 2010 and a SQL Server on your development box. And then you can download the SDK. There are also some training kits. And you find a lot of examples on the website code.msdn.com. The SDK allows you to build your applications locally on your development environment and also test and run them. But once you want to deploy them, then you need an Azure subscription. There are a lot of different offers for that subscription. There is a free offer, there is an offer that is based on your MSDN subscription, and there are some production consumption pay-as-you-go plan. And besides that, we have some promotional offers. First, a word about the introductory special. There is no charge for it, there is no commitment, and there is an amount of metrics included. Like, for instance, for running your Windows Azure applications, you can run your application for 25 hours, totally free of charge. You have access to a SQL Azure database of 1 GB, and you have enough data transfer in and out to start your first application, to deploy it, and to test it live in the cloud. Next, we have the MSDN Premium subscription for customers that already have an MSDN subscription. They can log in into their MSDN environment and look for the Windows Azure platform link, and then you can create an Azure subscription. It's also free because it is part of your MSDN subscription, and there you have 750 hours that you can run your applications. So this means you can run them for a complete month. And you also have a SQL database. You actually have three SQL databases of 1 GB. So if you want to start, this is also a good option. You can also continue with that option because you are allowed to run production in that MSDN subscription. For the consumption rates, we have different offers also. One offer is the Windows Azure Core, which costs about 42 euros. This is enough also to run for a whole month your applications, but it doesn't contain SQL. For that, we have the second option, SQL Azure Core. There you have a 10 GB SQL Azure database at 25% discount. The third offer is a combination of the two. So you have on one hand the compute hours, on the other hand the SQL database. If you want to combine them, there is the Windows Azure and SQL Azure Extended offering. Okay. So then let's continue with the presentation, of course. This presentation is about architecture. But I especially want to focus in this session on scalability. Azure is a platform that supports to build scalable applications. So let's define what is scaling, what is scalability, what does scaling means. Well, for me it means you can add more compute and storage capacity to handle some peak usage in your application. And you can do that in a simple way, in a very graceful manner. Two main options to perform scaling. One we call scale out. Scale out means you're going to add more instances of exactly the same setup, of exactly the same power, and you will distribute the load across the multiple instances. On the other hand, we have scale up. Scale up means we're working with the same instance, but we're going to add more power, and we will not distribute the load. It is the same machine that will do the requests. Well, for Azure, We only work with the scale-out principle. So as a first architectural guideline or piece of knowledge is that you have to know is that Azure Compute is a scale-out system. There is a load balancer. We can change the number of instances of virtual machines that are running behind the load balancer to reach the scalability that we need. So creating scalable system means we're going to implement some patterns in as well the processing and also in the storage design of our applications to allow that we achieve the same performance under a high load as under a normal load. So this means we will not change our software to reach the high load. Our solution, our architecture should be feasible, should be allow that we can scale out. Basically, we have two options for scalable systems, patterns. First of all, we can have more processing power and storage capacities underneath our applications ready. And the other option is we can proactively distribute the processing to other places outside our application. So scalability is about making the correct combination of the two options from within your solution architecture. And both options, they rely on a platform to be there to scale. So Azure is that platform that allows you to create more processing power for storage, for processing power. It can also distribute your load to different tiers in your application, also outside your application. So now more to the practical level. What we really can do to create scalable applications. Processing power, storage. We can scale out to multiple instances, and we will do this based on performance metrics. Azure will not scale by itself. It depends on your solution or on some engine to look at the performance metrics and then execute some logic to trigger the scale out. I will show you that in the next slides, and I will also show you some code how to do this exactly, and I will post also the code to complete solution that you will see in the next few minutes. I will also post this to my blog. So scaling out to multiple instances is one thing. On the other hand, you need to decide on partitioning your data. So if you store data, you can store it in table storage, you can store it in SQL Azure. To make it really scalable, to attain the same performance when you have a high load, you need to partition your data. For table storage, we can work with partition keys. And for SQL Azure, we can implement a sharding technique, which means we're going to put several pieces of data in separate databases. Another practical technique to build scalable applications is to work with an architecture that is asynchronously. So it means it does some processing in the background. It immediately gives back some feedback to your end user. But the process itself, the high load of the process will be done in the background. And we will see in a moment that we can work with worker roles that can each take their own account of the processing in the background. On the other hand, we can also distribute load to other places. Instead of creating some techniques inside our application, we can define that some load, some processing needs to be done outside our application. I'm thinking about content delivery network. I'm thinking about authentication and authorization that can be federated. And also I want to mention a new technique that is coming in Azure, App Fabric Caching. So the agenda for the next, let's say, hour is I'm going to talk about six different elements: load balancing, async architectures, table partitioning, content delivery network, access control service, and caching. So So the first concept about scalability is the load balancer. If you deploy your applications on Azure, you're deploying them in a virtual machine, and you can specify how many instances of the virtual machine you want. And inside the data center, there is a load balancer that will take the requests for the URL of your web application, for instance, and it will load balance this across the multiple instances. It's a round robin concept, so every instance will get a message, will get the request, and there are no sticky sessions. So it means within a session you can go to one instance, and within the same user session the load balancer can redirect you to another instance. So this leads to the fact that we need to have some stateless applications. The applications cannot, by default, rely on having data in memory or data stored on the local disk of the virtual machines. You have to place them somewhere else, because we have no sticky sessions in based on the load balancer. The number of instances that you are deploying is configured in some configuration file. You see some XML file where there is clearly indicated that instance count equals 3. And this allows the fabric controller in the data center to start the number of instances that you have defined. And the idea about scaling is that you change this configuration file. If you need more power, and because your performance goes down, or you're expecting a high peak of usage in your application, you can change this number. You can change this number manually. You can go to your admin portal of Azure and you look up the service configuration file. This is an XML file, and you can change that manually. You can specify, well, instead of 3, I want to have 4 or maybe 10 instances. And at the moment you save that XML file again, the fabric controller in the data center will notice that and will start up more instances if needed, or even bring down some instances when you define that you want less instances. Okay. So with this background, we need to look for a solution how to scale up to multiple instances. And of course, we will do this based on performance metrics. So in this scenario, I will talk about performance metrics and how to scale up or scale out based on the metrics. So let's say we have an application running on 2 instances. Means we have 2 virtual machines. The load balancer will distribute the load across those 2 virtual machines. And we will define some scaling engine. The scaling engine could be a library which is referenced inside your application. But in most scenarios, that scaling engine will be an on-premises application that is monitoring your cloud application. Or that scaling engine could also be System Center Operation Manager. So what we do with the scaling engine, we want to define the metrics, and we want to define the polling intervals of the metrics. So metrics could be, for instance, the usage of your CPU, which is a number, which is a percentage from 0 to 100%. Or maybe the number of active ASP.NET requests per second. Those metrics need to be defined. You can define them within your application, but in many scenarios you will define them outside your application and have some monitoring tool ready to change the setup of the metrics that you want. And also you have to think about the polling intervals. You do not want to have, let's say, 10 metrics every second for a complete 24 hours in a day. This will be too much data. So you have to define, well, maybe you're interested in having some metrics every 5 minutes, and then you want to aggregate them every hour to some central database. Yeah. So the next step is the performance metrics are coming out of your application. And this is done automatically. Once you define the metrics, the Azure Data Center or the virtual machines running your application will output their performance metrics to a storage. And they will output that to table storage. So there will be a file created for you, And in that file, every polling interval, you will see some records appearing. And those records are your performance metrics. So for every metric that you defined, you will see some records. And also for every instance, and you will see the instance which has generated a particular performance metric, of course. Next step you want to do is you want to download the performance metric to a local database. The performance metrics are stored in your table storage, but it's not a good idea to query them from within the cloud every time. I think it's wise to have some schedule that will download the data, all the performance metrics, to a local database. So this could be a local SQL server which has the same schema as the table in table storage for the performance metrics, and you will have some schedule that downloads them frequently. Okay, so once you have all those metrics on premises, you need to have some logic, some code that will interpret the metrics. So it will, for instance, make an average of the last hour of the CPU utilization, and it will do this across the different instances. In normal conditions, you will see that every instance has the same processor load, because the load balancer will distribute the load. So if you interpret the CPU usage of one instance, you also know what is the CPU usage of all the other instances. And then you try to interpret it. You make an average, you make some calculations, and then you decide to scale up or scale out. I have to say scale out here in this situation, of course. Like, for instance, if for the last hour we have an average of CPU utilization of above 80%, then it would be wise to add some more instances. So then the scaling engine continues after it has interpreted the metrics and made a decision. The scaling engine then can change the configuration. There is some API. It's a REST-based API, but there is some library available on code.msdn.com that wraps the REST APIs into some friendly .NET library. With that library, you can change the configuration. So you need to have the correct credentials to do the management of your application, and then you can download that configuration, which is an XML file, and you can serialize that or deserialize it to an object in memory, and then change the number of instances. So once the configuration then is changed, then you publish that configuration back to the Azure environment, and the Fabric controller will do its work. It will see the changes in your configuration, and it will, if needed, start up another instance. So this means, well, after I think about 10, 15, maximum 20 minutes, the additional instance is running. And again, it will start the performance metrics. And we have three applications or three instances running. So in the database, if we download the performance metrics, we will see a record for every instance. So we can look up if our scaling was good enough. Maybe we need four instances instead of three instances. So the scaling engine needs to check the database as frequently as possible to look at the performance and to change configuration based on some decision logic. Going to show you some code for that, but first this is a screenshot of what you get of those performance tables. You get a timestamp. You will get for each record a field which contains the name of the role, which is your name of your application. And then you will see for every role instance, here you see web role 1 instance 0, and a little below that you see web role 1 instance 1. You see all the counters. Processor total percentage time, logical disk free megabytes, TCP free, V4 connections active. So this should look a little bit familiar, because these are the typical counters, performance metrics counters, that you will also use in an on-premises environment. If you want to check the performance of applications running on your local environment, you would need to use the same counters. So use the same counters also in Azure. So for every few seconds, then you have a counter value for all the different counters for each role instance. Like I said, this is done automatically, but you have to configure this in your application. Here you see an example of working with the Diagnostics API, which is part of the service runtime library. You call the get default initial configuration method, which gets you, like it says, the default configuration, and then you can add some performance counters. You can say, well, I need a counter specifier, the total percentage of the processor time, the 3 megabytes on my local disk, and you specify the sample rate. And the sample rate is a time span where you defined, well, here in this example, for every 10 seconds, I want to have this metric. Okay? And at first phase, the metrics are kept in memory, but you define on this last line here, you define the interval of the scheduling. So you tell to the diagnostics monitor, well, for every minute, you need to transfer all those metrics to the table storage. But then again, they are just in table storage. You have to, or either you interpret them over there, but in many scenarios, you will download them to local SQL database. So once you have configured all those diagnostics, then it's time to start the diagnostics monitor with this new diagnostics monitor configuration. Yeah. The code that you see here on this slide, this can be implemented in the start of your application, but you can also implement this in an application which is running on premises. So then you will have some connection to some instance, and you can change the diagnostics configuration of an instance which is already running. So this allows that, like in production, you can say, well, I don't want any diagnostics. But if you see a problem, if you think, well, we have some performance problems, but we don't know for sure what is causing that performance problems, then you can change this diagnostics configuration. So you keep your application running, but it is the scaling engine that will configure your running application and will add the performance counters and will add the scheduling to the application which is running. And then you wait for the schedule transfer, and then you will see the metrics appearing in your tables. So this also means you can stop the diagnostics also. If you say, well, I know what the problem is and I can solve it by adding more instances, well, then you can talk to your production environment again and remove the performance counters from that diagnostics environment. Another piece of code that I want to show you is how easy it is to change the configuration from within code. Like I said, the configuration is just an XML file, and you can write some code that takes the XML file just as a string somewhere, and then gives it to a method, change configuration by slot. And that takes a few parameters, and you need to have a WCF channel to your Azure account. Your subscription ID, which is a unique identifier of your subscription. The name of your service, the deployment slot, which can be staging or production. And then you give it a new configuration as a string. So the method you see here, change configuration by slot, this method can be found in a library. You can find it on msdn.com. And it wraps your call into some REST API and will call out to the management API to change that configuration. Okay? Okay, I'm going to show some more code, and for that I'm going to move to my desktop. I'm going to share my desktop here, and you will see Visual Studio. So this is my web role here. Normal web role containing ESPX pages. It has this webrole.cs file, which is the role entry point. And in this role entry point, I change my diagnostics, like you've seen on the slide. Okay. Going to show you some other piece of code. I cannot run this application because it will take me too long to start it up and to change it. So it's not very practical to see this in a demo, but I will just show you the code. Going to show you some other piece of code here, an application that I have written that will synchronize the diagnostics that are in table storage in the cloud. It will synchronize that with a local database. So here I have this performance data class, and the performance data class will take all the parameters or just defines the structure of the performance data. Deployment ID, role instance, counter name, and counter value. And it needs some context, so you can use the context to have access to your data storage. And on the other hand, I have an entity framework model, which maps an object to some table locally. And the structure of that table is identical to the storage environment. Let's have a look at this. This is just a create table statement with all the needed fields. And then I have some application that will just also use a time span to start downloading all the metrics in the cloud and have them inserted into some local database. So then the local database looks like this. I'm going to start this local database quickly. So then you have all those metrics downloaded to your local environment. And then you need some code to do the interpretation. Okay. So then I will show you more about how to change the number of instances. This application is relying on a library, Microsoft.samples.windows, Azure.service management. I will post the complete solution to my blog, and I think at the end of the presentation I will show you the URL of the blog, and I will show you how to do that. So here in my form, I'm simply calling, like in this case, do change configuration, and here you see that same code. I'm just setting up my configuration file and then do the change configuration by slot. And this is calling to some WCF endpoint, which is wrapped around the REST API to load up that new configuration. Okay, that's it about code. I'm going back to my presentations here. I need to go back to my PowerPoint. That's it. So this concludes the part of scaling out based on metrics, based on the management API. Next topic that I want to talk about is working with an asynchronously architecture. What is this exactly? Well, it's an architecture which is could be based on queues. In Azure, we have this concept which we call queues. And queues are actually the communication between a web role, and a web role is your web application. It runs on IIS, serves you ESP.NET pages. And in the background, we have worker roles. And worker roles have this typical endless loop, and they are not by default accessible from the internet, but they have this endless loop. And in this endless loop, we will poll for a message. And if we get the message, then we will start processing it. And maybe this will take a few seconds. We will need to open a database and maybe communicate with other services and do some heavy calculations. So this means, well, one of the instances will be busy and maybe another one will be free. In a perfect situation, we will have lots of work roles that are busy, right, because we want to process everything. And only the one which is free, which means, well, we are at the top of the loop and we are just polling for a message. And if there is no message, then we wait for an amount of time and then we start polling again. But this means once one of the instances is free. So it will execute the get message method, and it will get a message if there is one, because the web role will have inserted some message in the message queue. A message is actually just a string. You can put whatever you want in it. In many scenarios, this will be the serialization of an object. And then on the other hand, the work role can deserialize it back to know what are the parameters of the process that has to be executed. So for that, we also have a very good API. In the box here at the top of the slide, you see this typical while true endless loop in your worker role. So you will poll for a get message, and if the message is there, then you will do your processing. Okay. So how does this relate to scalability? Well, look at the code in the box at the bottom. I could write, and this could also be part of my scaling engine that is running on premises, for every queue that I have in the cloud, I can ask the approximate message count. So this will give me a number of the number of messages that are not processed yet. So because if a worker role is finished processing the message, it will need to delete the message. So if we see a lot of messages in the cloud queue, and this means, well, there are not enough workers that can read the message. Every worker is busy doing his processing, and we keep on adding messages from within the worker role. We keep on adding messages to the queue, but they don't disappear. And the reason why they don't disappear from the queue is because all the worker roles are busy doing another message. So if we see that the approximate message count reaches a high number, and we can compare that, for instance, to some calculations of how many messages one worker role can handle, if we see that the message count is higher than the number of messages that, well, the set of worker roles can handle, then it's time to also do a scale out. So by using the same technique, calling to the management APIs and changing the configuration file, we can also scale out. So here in this scenario, we don't scale out based on performance metrics that are defined in my application, but I scale out based on the number of messages that are not processed yet. And if I see a high number, it's time to add some more instances of my worker role, because then a lot of worker roles will keep on getting messages from the same queue, and the queue will become empty because I have more worker roles that are doing the same. And also I can do the opposite of scale out. I can remove some instances. If I see that the approximate message count is zero or a very low number, it means, well, I could have instantiated too much work roles. So then I need to change my configuration again to change it back to some number that I have less worker roles. And then again, if the web roles are inserting data into the message queue, I will see that messages are appearing back in my queue, and then I do a scale out again. So you see, the scaling engine needs to look constantly to the approximate message count from the cloud queue and make a decision based on that. So very interesting scenario here. Also remember here, this code to know the number of messages, this can also run on premises. So from within a kind of monitoring application, you can constantly look at some queue that is actually in the cloud, which is a queue between the web role and the work role, and you can see the message count. So that was about creating some asynchronously architecture based on queues. Next item is about table partitioning. I'm here talking only in this section about Azure storage tables. I'm not talking about SQL Azure. I'm just talking about the tables which are part of the Azure storage technology. And what is about partitioning your data is, well, partitions are the way that you create scalable tables. Because if you define multiple partitions in your tables, the system, and the system here is Azure itself, can respond to some heavy load by isolating the hot partitions to dedicated servers. So if you store data on table storage, based on your partitioning schema, and based on the load of your code that is querying or inserting or updating your tables, we will isolate some hot partitions and place them on dedicated servers. This can happen without intervention of you. So this scales rather automatically if you create the correct partitioning schema. Yeah? So it provides the automatic load balancing of partitions across multiple servers, and it is there to meet the traffic needs of you are accessing blobs, tables, and queues, and so on. Another way to partition your data is, and we will see this in the last section, is you can consider using Windows Azure Content Delivery Network for if you have anonymous access to blobs, and you can distribute them across multiple data centers. So you can say, well, this blob needs to be stored in a data center which is very closely to the end user. So this is what I've talked about in the beginning of the presentation. We can distribute the load, and the load here is reading our blobs, to some places outside our application. Okay. So how does this partitioning mechanism works? Well, for every table that we create in Azure Storage, we have some fields, of course, and we also have a partition and a row key. So two of the fields need to be dedicated for the partitioning schema. A partition key and a row key, both of them are just a string. The combination of them has to be unique. So the combination of partition key and row key, this could be considered as the primary key of your table. You also see in tables we have an additional mandatory field, which is the timestamp. The timestamp is there to allow concurrency, to allow the detection of concurrency violations. Okay. So if we specify in our table a partition and a row key, the system Azure can make advantage of that to distribute the records to multiple servers to keep achieving the same performance results across multiple servers, of course. So here in this example, we see three records. One record has partition key A and row key 1, 2, 3. And then a second record has also partition key A and row key 1, 2, 4, because the combination has to be unique. And a third record has the partition key B and row key also 1, 2, 3. Well, from the logical point of view, this is just one table. But if we look to the physical location of our data, it could be, based on performance, that the data will be distributed across different storage nodes. So we have a storage node for partition A containing the first two records, and another storage node for the third record. So you don't have to do that yourself. It is the fabric controller running in the data center that will look up your performance for that table, and if it sees, well, the performance is going down, it will distribute the data across multiple storage nodes, so it will have a high performance again, because you're working with two different storage nodes. This happens automatically. If we have a high peak in usage, it will do that automatically, but you understand, to make advantage of that, you need to think about how to define your partitions and how to define partition key and row key here. All right. So up to number four here, or already number five, I've talked about the Azure Content Delivery Network. What is this exactly? Well, it works like this. If a user wants to request a blob on your storage, and that blob can be some JPEG file or some multimedia stream that you have created, the user will request a blob to some CDN node. So it's up to you to define in your admin portal that you want to use those CDN nodes. CDN nodes are servers which are outside the Azure data center. They are running in data centers as closely as possible to the end user. So what happens if the user requests some blob? Well, the CDN node will look up if the blob is already cached inside that CDN node. And if not, it will go to your original place in the Azure data center for your blob storage. And then it will give it back to the user. And then it will also, for an amount of time, it will keep a copy of that blob storage in the CDN node. So this is also a way to make your application scalable, because you don't want to have, and you don't need the processing power inside applications to download blob files. You can distribute them outside your application, and even with the content delivery network outside the data center. Okay, this is number five. That was a typo in the presentation, I noticed now. Federated authentication using Azure Access Control Services. Also a way to distribute the load outside your application, because authenticating and authorization of users, this could impact your performance, because for every user that logs in into your system, you have to look up in some database the correct password, or maybe a hashed password, and you want to compare if it has the correct password. This could take a lot of performance in your application. Think about that you're working with an application which has maybe 10,000 users, or maybe in the future 100,000 users. This is not very scalable if you want to do this inside your application. The idea about AppFabric access control is that we are going to work with identity providers which can do the authentication for you, and they're going to do this outside your application. Like for instance, as an identity provider in the public internet, we have Windows Live ID, of course, but also Google, Yahoo, and Facebook ID. They are valid identity providers, and they will check your password and will allow you to use your system if the password is correct. Yeah. On the other hand, we also have some private identity providers. We're running most of the time in an Active Directory domain, and if we implement Active Directory Federation services, we can have the Active Directory actually not published, but it will be used also for our web applications running on Azure. It will do the identity authentication for us. So how does this work? Our web application will redirect the login to those providers. So instead of having an ASP.NET form with a username and a password, we're just redirecting to some other identity provider. And this is done from within the framework. ASP.NET and Azure knows about this system. So it's only a matter of configuring your web application that it redirects the login to some other identity provider. And you can select which identity provider that is going to be used, or maybe a set of identity providers. This can be configured in the access control environment. So after the login was redirected, so then you do the authentication in that the identity provider, you're redirected back to your web application. And instead of having the password of that user, you're getting some claims in your web application. And you will not need to check the password again with your database behind your web application. No, you're just going to interpret the claims that you have been given by the access control service. So the claims can perform actually the authorization. You can see, is the user allowed to do something in my application? Yes, he is, because he has a set of claims. If he doesn't have the claims, okay, maybe he is authenticated already, but he cannot provide the correct set of claims, then you're not authorizing the user to do something. So here we see the same logic. It's about distributing the load, the load of the login process. We're going to distribute it outside our application. It's the Azure Access Control Service in combination with the identity providers that will do the authentication for you. Of course, there are some rules. You want to map claims to another set of claims. You want to create some authorization rules. And this is the responsibility of the access control service. So in Azure, we have this App Fabric Azure Access Control Service. Here you can define the rules and which identity providers are needed. What claims are you expecting from the identity providers? They have to be transformed to another set of claims that your application can understand. Those rules can be defined in Access Control Service. Last topic that I want to discuss is using caching. Caching is also a way to make your applications more scalable or make them more performant. What we do with caching is we're going to use some in-memory cache, which is distributed, and it is also a cloud service which is part of the App Fabric. It's not currently available. It's in a kind of CTP or beta phase at the moment, but it will be offered also as a cloud service. So you can very easy use this service, and what it does is it keeps data that you will otherwise keep in memory of your virtual machine in the cloud. It will keep that in a separate place. It will be distributed. It will be high available, and every instance can use that same in-memory cache. For the people that have experience with Windows Server App Fabric, there was a product which we called Velocity. Well, it's exactly the same capabilities. And Windows Server App Fabric caching is also known as Velocity, while App Fabric caching in the cloud is the technology with the same concept, with the same goals and the same capabilities. You can programmatically interact with the cache. So this would mean that you can also pre-populate the cache from an on-premises application. Let's say that our web application, in the web application we have this big drop-down with all the names of the cities in a country. Instead of loading them each time again and again from the database, you will load them once and then keep them in some caching. The problem is, because we're running on behind the load balancer, we need to keep that in memory for every virtual machine, but not with the App Fabric caching. We can do this centrally. But as you know, you can programmatically interact with that cache. And this can also be done, and because it's based as a cloud service, you can pre-populate the cache from within your on-premises application. So you can also change the cache of your applications running in the cloud by calling some script that runs locally. Maybe it will load up some database locally and then change the cache for your cloud applications on Azure. For the App Fabric caching, we also have some providers for session state and page output caching, which are compliant with the normal ASP.NET providers to do session persisting. So without any change in your code, just by simply changing the configuration of your web application, you can tell to the environment that it needs to store the session of multiple instances running, it needs to store that session in some central place, and also for page output caching. So the scenarios for this AppFabric caching are, if you have stateful applications that need to run on a multi-instance environment. And by default, we will have a problem because the load balancer distributes the requests. While with AppFabric caching, we can still have session variables of or page output caching in our application. And without changing the code, simply by reconfiguring our configuration, we can distribute that data to that AppFabric caching served, implemented as a cloud service. So we can do this for stateful applications, just for normal ASP.NET page caching. And like I've given you the example, we can speed up access. Instead of loading it from a database, we load it from caching. We can do this for some static data that you want to show on your application. So this is how it works. Multiple instances have simply access. Right? It's a very simple concept. Multiple instances can have read and write access to some central data storage. Also, your on-premises applications can do that. So this concludes a lot of topics about scalability. We have seen the need for scalability, how to solve the scalability problems, different scenarios, different options to have a scalable application. So this is the end of the presentation, but it's almost 3 o'clock. Still some 22 people are attending. Very nice to see that. I think we will have some time left for question and answer. So if you have some questions, feel free to ask them. I think Anthony will see those questions and try to distribute them to me. I will try to answer them. Okay?
Yep. We've already got one question that came in while you were presenting. And the question is from Bart Thierry, and he is asking how to calculate the transaction or storage costs when using Azure queues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a question about pricing. It's always good to see if people are thinking about pricing, then they are already moving ahead with Azure. Very good question. So what about transaction and storage costs when working with Azure queues? Well, for every message that you put into the Azure queue, you will pay for a transaction. For every time you do a GET message, you will pay for a transaction. Also, even if there is no message in the queue, you will pay for a transaction. But then again, you have to look at the price for a transaction. The price for a transaction is very, very low. It's extremely low. You pay, in US dollars indicated, you pay $1 for a batch of 10,000 transactions. So if you pull your queue 10,000 times, for that you will pay $1. And if you store 10,000 messages into the queue, this will also cost you $1. So you pay for that queuing system, but it's a very low number. And then you have to also have a look in your architecture. It's maybe not a good idea to have an endless loop that is pulling your queues every time. I mean, you need to have some scheduling mechanism. Like, for instance, if you see there is no message in the queue, you will not read immediately thereafter again the queue. Maybe you will wait for 1 minute. And so you save some GET messages cycles. And if after 1 minute there is still no message in the queue, then you could decide, well, to wait for another 5 minutes. And if there is no message after 5 minutes, maybe you will wait for a quarter of an hour, and so on. And at the moment you see a message appearing suddenly, then it means, well, your worker role, your web role is active and is inserting your data into your message queue. After you have read one message, then you can change the interval back to, instead of every quarter of an hour, then you go back to every minute. And if you see a lot of messages still appearing in your queue, then you change it back to every second, for instance. So the polling interval of your get messages API, you need to think about it, and you need to define this in your application that you will not read much messages. If there is no messages, there is no need to keep on reading it again. Yes. Another option that you can save money on working with Azure Queues is you can either decide to have one message as a result, or up to 32 messages. So with one get message call, you can read 32 messages. If there are 32 messages inside your queue, with one call you can read them, and then you actually have a kind of list of all the messages, and then you can distribute them on multiple threads in your work role. And if you read multiple messages in this way, it will only count for one transaction. So if there are 32 messages inside your queue, and you execute the get messages API, which will result in those 32 messages, it will only count as one transaction. But it's up to you as a developer to decide if you read one message or if you read multiple messages. So you have to think about a lot of things, and you need to know the costing model. But then again, it doesn't cost you that much, and from within your code, you can optimize how you work with the number of transactions. All right.
Okay, so for the moment, there are no more questions coming in, but I'd say feel free to take your time to pose them. We'll be here for another few minutes to answer them. So take your time. Okay, we've got a question from Geert, and he's asking some details about database sharding.
Sharding.
So he's asking what it is and what's the purpose typically used.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you talk about database sharding, you're talking about SQL Azure. The basic concept is actually the same, like I've shown you in the presentation about working with partition keys in table storage. So the purpose of the usage scenario is exactly the same. You want to distribute data across multiple databases. Because we have this limit of 50 gigabytes in SQL Azure, and if you want to go beyond 50 gigabytes of storage in a SQL Azure database, you need to distribute that in multiple databases. So sharding is the concept, is the technique that makes your application aware of the fact that your data is inside or could possibly be inside different or multiple databases. So your application will maintain a list of connection strings to different databases, and it will look up the query that you're executing, and based on the query, it will decide whether to go to database 1 or to database 2, for instance. So the typical use scenario is if you have a huge amount of data beyond 50 gigabyte, and the purpose is to distribute the data across multiple databases. So your application will know how to find the correct database. The trigger how to find the correct database is most of the time in many scenarios is based on the where clause of your SQL statement. So you need to interpret your SQL statement and see, well, for this where clause, I see, well, I'm selecting, for instance, invoices for this customer, and I know this customer has his data in this database. So you go to this particular database based on the query parameters of your SQL statement. For now, you have to do this in your application yourself, creating that sharding logic and distributing the queries to multiple databases. You have to do that in your application itself, in your data access layer. But in future versions of SQL Azure, we will see some more support for that. Then we're talking about another technique based on sharding, which does exactly the same, but abstracted away from your application. So your application simply executes SQL statements, and it is up to the database itself that knows how to distribute it to other databases. But that's something for the future. We will not see this right now, but this is on the roadmap. All right, next question.
Yep, the next question is from Mr. Van Kerk, and he's asking, with SQL Azure, what the cost is of one read data and one write data? Yeah. Is that the same as a queue message?
No, it's totally different than working with queue messages. For queue messages and for everything that you're storing in table storage, and this could either be simple tables and blobs and queues, in Azure Table Storage and Azure Storage in general, you pay for the transaction cost. If you compare this to SQL Azure, there is no transaction cost in SQL Azure. So the answer to the question is, what is the cost of one read and write data in SQL Azure? Is there is no cost involved. You can write and insert and delete and update and select as many times you want. It will not be billed. You will only pay at the end of the month for the usage in capacity, the number of gigabytes that you have stored in your SQL database. So you don't pay for any license of SQL Azure, you don't pay for the hardware, you do not pay for the transactions, so reading and writing does not cost you money, but you only pay for SQL Azure for the storage that you have, that you needed during the month. So only the number of gigabytes that you stored are appearing in your bill, but not the transactions. So in SQL Azure, you don't pay for transactions. In table storage, which is a lot cheaper than SQL Azure, but then you pay for transactions in table storage.
Okay, then we've got a question from Marco Veneke. And he's asking, how would you implement long-running processes in Azure? So he thinks there's a kind of impedance mismatch between the short-term patterns of the Azure queuing and, for example, document processing process.
Okay, complicated question. I was still thinking about it. So implementing long-running processes in Azure is typically done in a worker role. It has this endless loop and reads some messages from the queue. Based on some scheduling interval, and then executes it until the process is finished. So the concept about Azure queues is that if your application, your worker role, reads some message from the queue, it needs to also indicate when the process is finished by deleting the message from the queue. If your worker role is not deleting it because you have forgotten it as a developer, but also in the case of a hardware failure, if the message is not deleted from the queue, then that message is appearing in that queue again and maybe could be picked up by another worker role. So it's a continuous loop that will just have a kind of look at all the messages, execute them, and then if the process is actually finished, everything is stored in a database or all the services are called that you want to do, or like for instance if you want to process documents and the processing of the documents is finished and you stored the end result on storage somewhere, then you need to delete the message from the queue, so it will not reappear back into a queue. All right.
Okay. Then here again about database sharding. So he's asking if it can be used for handling multi-tenancy, and can it also be used to guarantee that one customer doesn't see the other customer's data.
Yes, that's spot on. This is sharding can also be used to have the same schema defined in multiple databases, exactly the same schema, and use one database for each customer. So because you have control over the connection string that your application is using based on your SQL statement that you want to execute, it is guaranteed that that customer one will not see the data of another customer. Yeah. So multi-tenancy is also could be also be done by using the sharding technique. Yeah. But then still remember, sharding at this moment, sharding is something you do yourself in the data access layer of the application for now. In the moment, we will see some support from the SQL Azure environment to make abstraction of that. So to create multi-tenancy databases and sharding databases, we will see this from within the platform. All right. Next okay. question.
Next question is from Mr. Van Elk again. I think he's asking if handling multiple clients in the same Azure database will reduce costs.
Yes. Because if you create, let us give an example. If you have one database of, and if you provision the database to be 5 gigabytes in size, and you could store, let's say, 10 customers inside that database, and for the 10 customers you only need, let's say, 800 megabytes of data, then you will only pay for 1 gigabyte. So there is some kind of calculation mechanism for SQL Azure that says, well, either you decide for a database which is 1 gigabyte or 5 gigabyte, which we call the web edition, and there is another edition, the business edition, which is working with increments of 10, 20, 30, 40, and 50 gigabytes of database. Yeah. You can, for instance, create a very large database, but not use the disk space on it. And then if you not reach the increment, if you go below the first increment, you will only pay for the first increment. So if you store multiple clients in the same database, this would be more cost effective than if you would need to create a database for every customer. So let's say one customer needs a few hundred megabytes of data, yeah, and you give each customer a database of 1 gigabyte, you will pay for 1 gigabyte for each customer, compared to if you store all those megabytes of the multiple customers inside one database and you're not reaching the 1 gigabyte limit, you will only pay for 1 gigabyte. So it's more cost effectively to store them multi-tenant in one database. It's all a matter about deciding on the architecture and deciding on the requirements. But you could do it cost effectively if you're working with one Azure database.
Okay, then we've got another question from Marco. And he thinks a queue message should be deleted within a short time period. Mm-hmm. And then he's asking what to do when the processing takes days and not seconds or minutes.
Yeah, if it really takes days, I think the upper limit of having a message processed is 2 hours. So if it takes days, then you will take another approach. You will still work with queues, but you will need some additional logic beyond that typical pattern of getting a message and deleting the message. You will need some extra logic beyond that if it would really take more than 2 hours and it takes a few days, then you will need some extra tables and some extra logic to really know the process is finished or the process is not finished. You need to do that yourself. So queuing is actually a very basic system. You can build on top of that to make long-running processes And maybe you can use Workflow Foundation, which is storing the processes in a database. And you can use Workflow Foundation and long-running processes also in the cloud, because we're working with .NET Framework 4. So it could be stored on a SQL Azure database, the workflow data. But answer is, if the process takes a very long time, you will need to go beyond what we are offering with the queuing system and add some additional framework or additional logic to do that. Well, you will be, am I still on audio? Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's a good question. I need to take this offline, and I will ask some other people that know more about it. And because I'm more the technical expert, I'm not really the expert on how payment is executed. So feel free to drop me a mail with that same question. I will try to have a look at some other people that have more knowledge on this, and I will get back to you. All right. So drop me a mail if I just chat with you. You will have my email address. We have done this in the previous sessions also. Okay, I have sent my email address, I think.